From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of The Leonard Lopate Show, and I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of today's show. The rest of today's show is available for download and on-demand listening at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. Charles Darwin waited 20 years to publish his theory of evolution because he knew it would stir up controversy. Now, almost 150 years later, the American Museum of Natural History addresses that still raging controversy in a new exhibition simply called Darwin. Niles Eldridge of the museum's paleontology department is the curator of the exhibit. He's also the author of a new book called Darwin, Discovering the Tree of Life. It is from Norton, and I'm very pleased it has brought him back to my show today. Hello.
Hey, good to be back, Leonard.
So how well do you think most Americans really understand Darwin's theory of evolution?
Actually, probably not very well. Evolution has had a checkered history being taught in public schools. I don't think it's very deeply grasped by most Americans at all. I think science education in general is in bad shape in the United States.
Was it better understood when he proposed it? I remember reading that Huxley said, "It's so obvious, why didn't I think
How
of
stupid
it?
Not to have thought of it," he said. It turns out when he finally got around to publishing it in 1859, it was an idea whose time had come. And medical schools apparently were all full of this thinking. What was unique was the notion of natural selection. And that was new, and it caused some controversy, but all the young ones picked up on it, and the older ones rejected it.
But there's also the story of the bishop's wife who, when she heard that a man named Charles Darwin had come up with a new theory about human origin, said to her husband, "My dear, descended from the apes, let's hope it's not true, but if it is, let us pray it will not become generally known."
Yeah, that's a kind of a leitmotif of the whole struggle ever since.
And it has kind of worked out that way. But you say that there was when he finally did publish it, what led him to finally publish it 20 years after he came up with
It was a classic story in the history of science. Alfred Russel Wallace, who was a younger man, maybe by 13 years or so, was a fan of Darwin's. He took off and was collecting specimens with Henry Walter Bates in South America. And unlike Darwin, he was not a wealthy man, and he was doing this for a living. But he was a convinced evolutionist, even back in the 1840s. Some people think, actually, because he read Darwin's hints in the second edition of the Voyage of the Beagle in 1845. Anyway, he had this famous malarial dream in Ternate in what is now Indonesia, and he fired off a letter. He'd already been corresponding with Darwin. They were talking about evolution in correspondence, but the big thing was the natural selection. And as Darwin said, when he got this, he was floored because he said he couldn't have written a better abstract himself of his own ideas. And so that just shows that if you got a good idea, you ought to publish it. That's for one thing. And the other one is
that, had he already written the book? Was it just sitting
He had written several versions. My favorite, we have these all on display, or at least manuscript pages of them, is the 1842 35-page manuscript. It's really wonderful to read because he's still fresh and he's still working on the ideas. 1844 essays, much longer, a couple hundred pages. That is the skeletal basis of the origin of species. But yes, gathering dust, sitting around.
So when he discovered that Wallace might beat him to the punch, at least he had something ready to send out to a publisher.
Well, actually, no. He was working on his great species book. He was halfway through. Parts of it have subsequently been published. It's a wonderful book. It would have been enormous. Now, what happened was he got his friend Charles Lyell and Joseph Hooker, who was a botanist, Lyell's famous geologist. They stepped in, they took Wallace's manuscript and a couple of excerpts, one from the 1844 essay, one from a letter to a botanist, Asa Gray, over here, that Darwin had written, and put them together as a tripartite presentation to the Linnean Society.
Now, did Wallace have a Galapagos-type experience? Because you can, I guess, in South America, in Indonesia. You definitely can in Madagascar.
All the same kinds of evidence are all around us all over the world, absolutely. And as I say, there's some thinking that he was actually convinced that evolution had happened even before he left England in 1848, I think it was.
Well, Darwin once said that when he talked privately with friends about his theory of evolution, before the book was published, he felt like he was confessing to a murder.
Yeah, well, that was the letter to Joseph Hooker, again on display at our exhibit. We have all
this material. We have all this crown jewels here.
But that's it really makes the hair stand up on the back of my neck when I look at this. He says Hooker had just told him about the significance of his plants that he brought back from the Galapagos. And this is now 1844. Darwin had been home for since 1836. And he's finally getting the results of the botany. So he confesses, in a sense, in this long letter to Hooker, that he's been engaged in a very presumptuous act. And it is like confessing a murder. The species are not immutable.
How did his life change after the theory was published?
Well, you know, he had already become basically a recluse with ill health every day. Since 1842, he moved out of London down to the countryside. So he'd already been there, ensconced in the countryside with his 10 children and his wife for 17 years by the time he finally published the book. So I understand that his symptoms, his gastrointestinal ailments, actually flared up. He started doing a lot of botanical experiments to get his mind off the public reaction, working with his son Francis in particular. So he just work, kept going.
But didn't he also, like so many people involved in medicine and psychology, apply his theories to his own life and worry that he was passing on certain genetic predispositions to his kids?
Yeah, he married his second cousin, and it was already just empirically known that that could lead to bad things. And indeed, three of their children, two of the three who died, he was concerned that it was because of a bad mix of genetic information.
Now, the cousin was from the Wedgwood part of the family. We're talking about the Wedgwood pottery people, aren't
Absolutely.
We?
Absolutely. He had two very interesting grandfathers. One was Josiah Wedgwood, who founded the Pottery Works, and was an early savant, very successful, very interested, very free-thinking. He was a liberal. He was totally against slavery. He had a famous medallion that he cast in famous Wedgwood style. It was an anti-slavery a piece. The other grandfather was Erasmus Darwin, who was a physician, very successful also, and wrote Zoonomia, which was actually a book about medicine and zoology, but also contained a discussion of evolution. So that was interesting, too.
And did that inspire him, do you think?
Well, you know, I'm beginning to think that that's underplayed, because there was that grandfather, Erasmus, but also there was Robert Grant, who he met up in Edinburgh, a young man who loved Lamarck and loved Erasmus Darwin, who was an evolutionist when it was not a good time to be an evolutionist. And he influenced Darwin, too, a great deal.
Well, what were their theories?
Well, Lamarck's theory was...
Well, we know Lamarck's theory, right, but was Erasmus Darwin similar?
Yeah, sort of similar. It was based basically on Lamarck. Again, there was no really cogent mechanism like natural... That was the real bottom line there. But with Grant, he was collecting invertebrates up in the Firth of Forth instead of going to medical classes and looking for connections between animals and plants in the sea life there.
Well, Darwin, his father wanted him to become a doctor and then a clergyman.
Right.
So what happened?
Well, his father, Darwin wrote this great autobiography published late, it was never published in his lifetime. He wrote it for his kids. And he recalls that his father says, you care for nothing but shooting dogs and rat catching, and you shall be a disgrace to yourself and your entire family. And he felt that this boy, who he loved dearly, Darwin's mother died when he was 8, so it was a close-knit family. His older sisters basically raised him. Father was very fond of him, but despaired because he didn't like school, and he just liked the great outdoors. So he said, you got to have a profession. He sent him up to Edinburgh, where his older brother was, to study medicine. Darwin hated the sight of blood, the screams of the patients, and so forth. So his father yanked him because it was throwing money away and sent him to Cambridge.
But I would have thought that medicine would have grabbed his attention.
You would have.
Because... all the science behind medicine has since has evolved from his theory, and on top of it all, there is a kind of a biological medicinal kind of
exactly.
connection,
deep connection. No, it does seem kind of surprising. Also, for the rest of his life, he referred himself to himself primarily as a geologist, and there was a very famous geologist. Interestingly enough, lecturing at the medical school, and he hated those lectures and found them boring. So what it was a 16-year-old kid who would much rather be outdoors than in a classroom at that time. Immature.
Niles Eldridge is curator of the American Museum of Natural History, the author of many books, co-discoverer with Stephen Jay Gould of the theory of punctuated equilibrium. And he's written a book called Darwin, Discovering the Tree of Life, which is published by Norton. And he is also the curator of the major exhibit now at the American Museum of Natural History called Darwin. What do you make of the CBS News poll last month that revealed that 51% of Americans reject the theory?
We're at a high watermark, there's no question. I've written two books already of my career on creationism. This is nothing new, but it's very vociferous right now.
But it seems like we're going backward. I mentioned earlier that when I was in school, I don't think anybody ever questioned the theory of evolution, and that was many, 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 many years ago, and now here we are kind of back with the Scopes trial.
Well, Leonard, you must have gone to school in New York City. There are plenty of places around the country where evolution has never really been accepted. I think, though, and your previous guest, Bob Pollack, made the point that this is something that it's tied into the political situation that we have right now. I do expect that we've seen the high water mark. I think it's going to recede. We didn't mount this exhibit to basically attack this at all. It's just sort of a fortuitous thing. But our basic objective is to show the evidence for evolution, and I'm hoping we're going to have some sort of an effect on that.
Well, the term creationism seems to have fallen out of favor, replaced now by the theory of intelligent design.
Well, it's evolved.
Do you think it's pretty much the same thing?
It is the same thing.
Because in 1987, the Supreme Court ruled that creationism is a religious belief that cannot be taught in schools. And
right.
So now we have
intelligent design.
Well, first
it was creationism, then it became scientific creationism. And there was a big trial down in Arkansas that Steve and I were involved with. And the judge said, if this stuff is science, why do we need a law to teach it? And it was seen to be a wolf in sheep's clothing. And this intelligent design stuff, which goes back to the Reverend William Paley in 1802, is just another name for exactly the same thing. It's an assertion that evolution is inadequate to explain the complexities of life. It's just an assertion. It goes no further.
But we're seeing changes even in major religions. Pope John Paul II said the theory of evolution and church teachings could coexist,
exactly.
That the body may have evolved, but the soul was created directly by God. But now Pope Benedict is suggesting that maybe there are some problems.
Exactly. Well, doctrines are not written in stone in religion, you know, and science marches on, but religion changes too. Again, I do think it's largely political. I don't think it's, Bob was saying, it's bad theology, and it might very well be bad theology. I'm not a theologian, I don't know, but I think there's lots of reasons why doctrines shift and change inside churches as well as other walks of human life.
There, the show at the American Museum of Natural History has been drawing huge crowds. Have you been getting any sense of how people are reacting?
Yeah.
What about people who object to the exhibit?
None have shown their faces so far. Everybody's welcome. I'm hoping that people will come. As my wife says, don't bring your kid to the show if you don't want your kid to believe in evolution. It's that powerful. But I was in there yesterday with some visiting biologists, and people were coming up to me and talking about the exhibit, and we're finding that the reaction so far is 100% positive.
I get the feeling from the exhibition that it would be hard to overemphasize the importance of Darwin's theory of evolution. Did Darwin himself have any idea of just how important his theory would become in the development of so many sciences?
I'm not sure if he thought that way, but again...
Did he have an inkling of genetics, for example?
No. He had his own theory of inheritance because he knew he ought to have one, and it was dead wrong. I mean, he thought that little recruits were sent from all parts of the body to be a nose or to be a finger or what have you. You know, it's just no concept, nothing remotely like what we have.
Who right will now volunteer to become a nose?
Exactly. But... the interesting thing about that to me intellectually is that natural selection does not depend upon having an accurate view of what inheritance is, but he knew he needed one.
But I wonder how we can live in a world which people go to hospitals and get tested
exactly
for their genetic makeup and then say, well, this is based on false science.
That's exactly right. Americans are very good at accepting the fruits or the benefits of scientific research. They're not always so good about accepting the underlying thinking about it. I mean, my favorite example right now, it's so fresh we couldn't even put it in the exhibit, is the avian flu the real concern that we all have about this. If we didn't know about evolution, we would not even be thinking about the possibility that perhaps this could become communicable directly between humans, which is what the big scare is, and that's evolution.
What were Darwin's feelings about religion? He once contemplated becoming a clergyman.
He did, and actually with pleasure, because he wanted to live a quiet country life and just collect his beetles and so forth. So he thought that would be good. Darwin stayed away from. He says he uses the word creator actually at the very end of The Origin of Species. He says that his theory, in his view, did not impinge upon religious beliefs, his or anybody else's. He wished that, and again, this goes back to what Bob said in the previous segment that you had, that the fate of his ideas would be the same fate as Newton's ideas and the other early astronomers, where they were seen to be anti-religious in a sense, and the church strongly opposed those, but then finally forgave these guys. And so the early physics and astronomy was incorporated into Western culture and basically causes no real difficulties anymore. From a religious perspective, he was really hoping evolution, natural law applied to biology would and human beings would also come to be seen that way. But the fact that it does have deep implications about who we are and where we came from and notions of immortality and so forth, that's the reason why people are still choking on it.
Well, do you think it's also because it goes against all of the creation stories that we have received from the different religions, or because of what seemed to appall people from the start, that it suggests that we descended from the apes?
Exactly. It's all about us. People don't care about my trilobites evolving or the dinosaurs and so forth. When you really get right down to it, it's who we are and where we came from. That's what really matters.
And the whole matter of dinosaurs having lived millions and millions of years ago, even though Earth is only 6,000 or 7,000 years old.
I mean, there are a lot of creationists who have dropped the young Earth creationism, requiring that the dinosaurs try to get on the ark and then fell off and drowned and things like that, because they know that actually goes against nuclear physics, the dating of rock through radioactive decay. So there are some creationists, at least, who have stopped that aspect of their thinking.
The Darwin exhibit will be at the American Museum of Natural History through May 29th and then move to Boston, Chicago, Toronto, and London. And the London exhibit will help
San Diego
launch.
Now.
San Diego too?
Yeah, that's new
150th
news.
Anniversary of the publication of On the Origin of Species. Niles Eldridge is the curator of the show, and he's also written a companion book called Darwin, Discovering the Tree of Life. It's published by Norton. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. I hope you can stay with us. I'm Leonard Lopate. Welcome back to my show. Continuing my conversation with Niles Eldridge, who is the curator of a major exhibition called Darwin at the American Museum of Natural History that runs through May 29th, also has written a companion book to this exhibition called Darwin, Discovering the Tree of Life, which is published by Norton. And I gather there's a third thing that you're doing. Aren't you teaming up with chefs Peter Hoffman and Matt Weingarten to do a dinner that illustrates Darwin's ideas about evolution and natural selection?
We're doing that.
How does that
down
work?
Down at the Savoy. You're going to eliminate
a couple of species along the way?
We've done biodiversity dinners in the past, and we've gone and just as guests at other ones, and they're a great deal of fun. But you learn things, too. So Darwin saw things that we show in the exhibit that led him to evolution, and he also ate a lot of things, and so it works in that way. But again, we've been breeding our own animals and plants for consumption for so long now that's another connection, too, that's pretty obvious.
Well, I understand that the dinner is already sold out, but that there will be an ongoing dinner series, which you will not be attending, which will also illustrate this. Yeah. But how does that work? How would a dinner illustrate Darwin's theories?
Well, we, for example, when we did the previous dinner on biodiversity, we tried to eat as many different phyla of plants and animals that we possibly could, jellyfish and whatnot and so forth. And I would talk between courses about the diversity of life and just different aspects of it. When Darwin was out on the Beagle as a very open-minded, passionate young man, of course, they didn't bring their provisions with them. It was supposed to be a 2-year trip. It ended up 5 years. So sailors then, as much as sailors now, forage. And so he was eating things like possums. He was eating things like guanacos, which are the small camels on the Argentinian plains, and rays, which are ostrich-like things. And they even ate the Galapagos tortoises, which he thought were put there expressly by sailors for food supply. It turns out they were native, but he didn't know that. But anyway, so he ate the very evidence that took him to evolution. So I think I'll just sort of riff on that when we're at the dinner.
Well, I think it may be ironic that Darwin and Wallace were both inspired by the 1938 essay on population by the Reverend Thomas Malthus, which was largely about starvation and things like that.
Right, right. That was 1798, actually. Oh. Thomas Malthus. It was old. It was musty. And apparently, Darwin never owned a copy of it. My friend David Cohn tells me that they think that he read it for amusement at the Athenian Club one night up in London in 1836. And that was the big aha, because Malthus was just writing about people. He says that, you know, the more mouths to feed, the more greater probability of starvation, because there's a finite amount. And you get a disaster like the Irish potato famine, which came along later, and there's great suffering, starvation, and death, and disease. So Malthus is right. There's a limit on the size of population. Darwin and Wallace independently saw that applies right across the board to all species on the face of the earth.
But it's interesting to think about that and then to think about the impact of Darwin's teacher at Cambridge, John Stevens Henslow. We tend to think of these great theories as having just come out of the blue.
Right.
Einstein the same way. But obviously a little thing happens here, another little thing happens
exactly
there.
So.
And the real genius is the person who can put it all together. The rest of us just see
exactly.
it and say, ah.
Right, because we already mentioned that the grandfather and Robert Grant were sort of planted seeds of evolution. No evidence that they really took, but no evidence that they didn't either. John Stevens Henslow was a reverend. So he was a creationist, and he was appalled by Darwin's evolutionary ideas when once they were finally published, because he was still alive, and had heard about them anyway before he died. But he did teach Darwin how to collect, and he thought that, like everybody else, that species were created separately, but that there were varieties within them, and it was very important to note the varieties and collect them geographically across England, for example, when you're collecting plants, because they're not all the same all over the same place.
And Henslow suggested that Darwin join the crew of the Beagle, didn't he?
He did. He actually turned down the opportunity for himself. He was just newly married and so forth, so he passed that opportunity on to Darwin. We have a series of letters. I mean, Darwin's father says, no, I mean, why did they take you? Obviously, you're the bottom of the barrel, and it's going to be costly, it's going to be dangerous. He had all these objections, but he did say, if you can find somebody whose opinion I respect, who thinks this is a good idea, I'll let you go. And that was Uncle Josiah Wedgwood, who said, oh, come on, Robert, let him go. It'll be a great thing.
Was the lack of faith from his father one of the motivating forces? Obviously, Darwin was a genius. Why would he be so underrated by his own father?
Well, I think his father, he thought he was sort of feckless. And he did take his Cambridge degree, which was an ordinary degree. He did well. He wasn't an all-star, but he did well. And then he was going to go on and study for the clergy. And his father was really worried that if he went off on this gallivanting around the world on this trip, that he'd end up actually doing nothing for the rest of his life. And I think, in a sense, being a father, you can see how, you know, you might have that fear.
Maybe he just didn't understand what his son was all about. Darwin was actually interested in geology, wasn't
Darwin,
he?
Yes.
And that plays a key role in all
absolutely.
This.
The other person that was a big influence on him at Cambridge was the Reverend, again, Adam Sedgwick, who was he was one of my old heroes. He's founded the Cambrian system, and he's one of the very early important geologists. He took Darwin out for 1 week geologizing, taught him how to measure the angles of rocks and figure out what's older and what's sitting on what and so forth at these outcrops in Wales. And it was only 1 week. And Darwin wrote to Henslow a letter when he was on the Beagle saying, please tell Professor Sedgwick how important that really was. Because his very first paper when he got back from the Beagle was on the geological uplift of the Andes Mountains, because he was thrown to the ground during a massive earthquake that in Concepcion in Chile. And he said, aha. And then he went back down to the beach eventually, and he saw these wet oyster beds propelled above, all of a sudden, standing out there in open air. And he said, aha, so that's what's going on. The Andes are going up in fits and starts. It's a gradual process in the sense that it takes a long time, but it's these violent earthquakes that are doing it. And he gave that paper in London. So, yeah, he loved geology.
Well, that's another form of evolution, isn't
it? It is. In fact,
the evolution of the surface of the earth.
What I haven't mentioned yet is that Charles Lyell, Henslow gives him volume one of Lyell's Principles of Geology and says, don't believe everything you read in here. And it's about interpreting the Earth because of the processes that we see around us now are the ones that were acting in the past. And you can use that to put together a theory of geological history and the theory of the Earth.
You've included a huge live green iguana in this exhibition. How important to Darwin's work was the discovery of the iguana?
Well, the iguana was something you would have seen on the mainland. It wasn't one of the main examples that he actually did call out. But the two iguanas that we have as models in the exhibit from the Galapagos were, because you can go see the lava, the marine iguanas, they look like the lava that they're sitting on. And then you go see the terrestrial iguanas, again, at the exhibit, and they're sitting on a much lighter colored, tufaceous sort of rock in the Galapagos. So the idea is that they're matching their backgrounds. It's an adaptive phenomenon.
He had vowed to eat the unusual animals that he found. Did he eat one of the iguanas?
You know, I'm not sure. He might have eaten an iguana on the mainland of South America. I don't know if he ate any of the gold. I'll have to look that up before the dinner.
Well, obviously it tastes like chicken. So, one of the arguments that that opponents to evolution have is that the theory is not complete yet. It still has a lot of holes
right.
in it. Now, you dealt with one of those holes with Stephen Jay Gould when
right.
he came up with punctuated
exactly.
equilibrium. Do most people already accept that theory
I think
by
the
now?
Punctuated equilibrium, which just says that most species don't change very much, even for millions of years once they evolve. But when evolution does happen, it can and does happen relatively rapidly.
Because of outside circumstances?
I think that's been absorbed fairly well into because of outside circumstances, right?
Like the death of the dinosaurs, for example.
Stuff like that. Darwin knew about this phenomenon, and he was so successful in saying, well, because he felt that it didn't fit in very well with his picture in his mind about how evolution should look through natural selection. So he decided there was something wrong with the rock record. He invented the new science of taphonomy, which is what all the stuff that happens after an animal dies, all the way up to when it, millions of years later, it ends up in somebody's study table at a museum or something like that. And he says, well, you know, the fossil record is not good enough to really give us a true signal here. But, of course, the fossil record is good enough to give us a signal. So he was wrong. And what he did, which was very uncharacteristic for him, was to ignore the evidence in favor of his prior notions about what the world ought to look like. So he basically stepped out of line himself. But he did it so well that he convinced the world so much that he was right that it took, 100 years for Gould and me to come along and straighten that out.
Well, how many holes are there still?
Well, there's another one. It's the mass extinction one he knew about. I love this thing I found. He wrote a little note in his unpublished 1844 manuscript. Says, better begin with this. If species really, after catastrophes created in showers world over, my theory false. And, of course, they are. We have these mass extinctions that periodically reset the clock. But, again, he couldn't – it was just a failure of his own imagination to see how natural selection and speciation, which he had worked out very well, could actually fit into that particular context. And so he shoved it under the rug. He never began with it. He never even mentioned it again.
But he did recognize that it was a problem.
He did recognize it was a problem. He's a very honest man, you know, honest to himself. But he never really brought that subject up again.
Didn't his health start to suffer after his return from his journey on the Beagle?
You know, yes. And he was seasick almost every day he was on the Beagle. So he spent, 80% of the time on the Beagle he spent on dry land, making all these great discoveries and so forth. He gets home. People wondered if he brought back some sort of an infectious disease from South America, Chagas disease. He was bitten by the benchuga bug, which apparently carries this disease. The thinking now is that this man was carrying a secret around, and his gastrointestinal symptoms best fit the depression and just sort of a repressed kind of an expression, a physical expression of an emotional problem.
Mm-hmm. So he had an uneasy stomach, in effect.
Yes, uneasy on a daily basis. And yet he loved to eat, which is kind of strange.
What do you think will surprise people most when they go to the exhibit?
Well, there are several things. The live animals do attract people. There's no question. We have two live Galapagos tortoises. You can actually see them on our museum internet site, our live webcam. That's pretty good. Otherwise, people are torn between What I was hearing yesterday was the original documents. They are, like David Cohn says, the crown jewels of Darwiniana, the letters, the manuscripts.
Can we read his handwriting easily?
Yes. When he was trying to write letters to people, he made every effort to be clear. I mean, scribbling his own notes, he was less successful at that. So many people think that. My own son said he felt an intimate connection with Darwin just by going through.
Niles Eldridge has written a companion book to the exhibit at the American Museum of Natural History, which runs through May 29th. The book is called Darwin, Discovering the Tree of Life. It is published by Norton. My great thanks to you for being with us today.
Oh, I'm sorry it's over so soon.
Thanks for listening to today's podcast of the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC New York Public Radio. This was just one of the show's segments. You can hear everything we do on demand at WNYC.org. Check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.